Welcome to the Hashtag Health Podcast. My name is Andrew, and I will be your host for this two-part series on the future of cardiac regeneration in medicine. We've all heard the hype before. Whether you've seen it on the news or read it in a medical journal, stem cell therapies have long been thought of as the future of medicine. The immense therapeutic potential of stem cells has led to plenty of research into how stem cells can be used to treat human diseases. And this is for good reason, as pluripotent stem cells can generate all the different cell types that make up the various tissues of the human body. Pluripotent stem cells are capable of this due to their two defining features: their ability to divide and make more copies of themselves, as well as their ability to differentiate into the more mature cell types that make up functional human tissues. It's these features of stem cells that are being studied in labs around the world and are helping us create stem cell-based therapies. In fact, stem cells are already being used in human therapies today. Bone marrow transplants use stem cells from a compatible donor to treat certain cancers of the blood. One area of medicine where stem cells are garnering more attention is their use in treating heart disease. Impact of this research can be enormous, as heart disease is amongst the leading causes of death and hospitalization in Canada and much of the world. To help us learn how stem cells are being used in cardiac research and where the field is heading, we are very excited to welcome our guest, Dr. Michael LaFlamme, the McEwen Chair in Cardiac Regenerative Medicine at the University Health Network's McEwen Stem Cell Institute in Toronto.
All right, Dr. LaFlamme, thank you. So why don't we get started with just telling us a little bit about who you are, what your roles are as a clinician and a researcher, and how you got started into stem cell research.
Yeah, so my name is Mike LaFlamme. I'm the McEwen Chair in Cardiac Regenerative Medicine in the McEwen Stem Cell Institute at University Health Network. I'm also a clinician scientist here, so I do diagnostic work as a pathologist. And also a part-time entrepreneur. So I actually am a founder of a company that operates in this space called Blue Rock Therapeutics. But I'm mostly a scientist, spend 80% of my time supervising a lab with about a dozen folks doing stem cell research. I actually came about this in a different direction. I was actually doing cardiac research before I was doing stem cell research. So I show my age, but I did my PhD in the 90s, so way back in the last millennium. And we were studying cardiomyocytes or heart muscle cells. At that time, if we wanted to get heart muscle cells, you basically had to extract them from a rodent heart. And so we were studying adult rat heart muscle cells, which you could do, but it was tedious. They're obviously not human. And really, at that time, you could only keep them alive outside of the body for a couple hours, which was obviously very limiting in trying to understand the physiology, trying to model disease and that kind of thing. And then it was just early 2000s, after I did my residency in pathology, I was doing a postdoctoral fellowship at this time in the United States in the University of Washington in Chuck Murray's laboratory. That we had the opportunity to start working with pluripotent stem cells, specifically human embryonic stem cells. This was pretty much right after George Bush, the president of the U.S., said you could do research on embryonic stem cells with federal funds. I think within 2 or 3 months, we were doing it. And it turns out you can get beating human heart muscle cells that way. It was much more difficult, and we're far, far better at it now, at guiding these cells that can become anything into heart muscle cells. But, even just the very first time we saw little beating foci, just, clusters of a few cells beating on a plate, that captured my attention and imagination and haven't, gone back since. So I came about this as a cardiac researcher first, and then saw the power of stem cells to answer questions and maybe to create new therapies.
Awesome. It's cool to hear how your story kind of comes full circle from where you started. Why don't you give us a brief overview of what your lab has been working on the last little while?
Yeah, so my laboratory is focused on developing cardiac therapy. for heart disease. We're specifically focused on particular form of heart disease. This is the heart failure that can occur after a myocardial infarction, or an MI, also known as a heart attack. And what happens in that disease is you have a blockage in one of the coronary arteries. These are the blood vessels that supply the heart. And because the heart is inherently very poorly regenerative, it may be the least regenerative organ in the body, the damaged muscle is replaced by non-contractile scar tissue. And we've gotten people much better through the acute phase of getting an event like that. We can get them to the hospital faster, and we have technologies to reopen the blocked blood vessel. But then we've run into this new problem that many of those folks can go on to develop heart failure, which is just means because they've lost heart muscle, they have less force generating capacity, pump capacity in their heart. They can go on to develop this condition where the heart can no longer pump to meet the demands of the body. And it's a really serious disease. 50% of people that are diagnosed with heart failure will be dead within 5 years. Different numbers out there, but a lot of people cite a median survival is just a little over 2 years. And currently our only way to replace the muscle that you lose to something like that is to give somebody an entirely new heart. Our current medical therapies are basically aimed at either slowing further disease progression or easing the symptoms of people that have heart failure, maybe removing some of the fluid off their lungs so they can breathe easier. And that's where this idea that our laboratory has been focused on, a number of other laboratories, is that rather than replacing the entire organ, we might be able to remuscularize the scarred, damaged portion of the heart. And then it's a question of cell source. And as we just discussed, there is the possibility of getting cardiomyocytes, definitive, unambiguous human cardiomyocytes from pluripotent stem cells. And so our laboratory has been pretty exclusively focused on issues related to that. So working out ways to guide these cells efficiently to become cardiomyocytes, more recently trying to focus on getting the right type of cardiomyocytes. So the ventricular cells that make up the pumping chambers of the heart, maturing the cells. So it turns out that one of the other challenges is that you can get cardiomyocytes, heart muscle cells, from stem cells, but they normally are immature, kind of like cells you'd find in the early fetal heart. So can we push them along to be more like the adult cells that they're replacing? And then testing these cells out in various experimental models of post-MI heart failure. And, you know, there's kind of a sort of stereotypical process that you need to go through, starting off usually in rodent models, mice and rats, and gradually working your way towards models that are closer to human. And so we've been focused on those kind of practical and translational issues related to trying to develop a novel cardiac cell therapy.
All right. Awesome. You can keep this very specific to cardiac stem cells, or you can open it up to like stem cell, the field in general, or even touch on like human pluripotent stem cells. But what have been some of the very important or new advances in the field that have kind of made everything more plausible today for your lab?
Yeah, so to me, the most exciting advance in stem cell biology during my career, and I might plausibly argue the most exciting advance in biology, it certainly would be on a top five list, was the discovery of induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPS cells, by Shinya Yamanaka, scientist in Japan. And it's one of these examples of the shortest interval between a discovery and getting a Nobel Prize. I think he won a Nobel Prize in 2011, if I'm correct for this. And these were discoveries that were made in the late aughts. And so pluripotent stem cells are these special type of stem cells that are defined by their ability to differentiate or give rise to all the cell types you find in the adult heart. And the kind of classic example of pluripotent stem cell are embryonic stem cells. And these you isolate from embryos that are, in the case of human embryonic stem cells, left over from in vitro fertilization. And what Professor Yamanaka showed is that you could take somatic cells, so just ordinary cells. It could be from a skin biopsy, it could be from a blood sample, it can even be epithelial cells you can isolate from voided urine, so dispensable cells, if you will. And you could reprogram these normal somatic cells to become the equivalent of embryonic stem cells. And you do that by transiently inducing them to express genes that are normally found in embryonic stem cells, and you get an equivalent of an embryonic stem cell. And that's why they're called induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPS cells. This is really exciting. I mean, it was one of these things that seemed like science fiction when it was first described by Yamanaka, but it was, again, one of these examples of something that was reproducible and was reproduced by many laboratories around the planet in quite short order. And it's really exciting because it offers the opportunity to access a pluripotent stem cell that might not have some of the political and ethical objections that are associated with embryonic stem cells. You know, I only half joke on it. I say we would otherwise worry about, could we have red state or blue state therapies? It gives us a solution to that. It also opens up the possibility of, and I think this is down the road, this isn't something that's going to happen anytime soon, but you can even think about personalized medicine, right? So you could think about taking a skin biopsy or a blood sample from you, making iPS cells that are equivalent to you, then making those into, cardiomyocytes, neurons, whatever, cell type is needed for your disease. And they would be genetically matched to the recipient, would avoid the need for immunosuppression and so on. Now, I think from a therapeutic standpoint, that's still quite a ways down the road. I think, there's going to be regulatory and sort of practical economic hurdles to that kind of individualized therapy. But what does open up, what's happened now, is the idea that you can use these iPS-derived cardiomyocytes or other interesting cell types as disease models. So if you or I or somebody that has a heritable form of heart disease and inherited cardiomyopathy, as I said, historically, the only way you could get cardiomyocytes was to disperse them from the heart. Well, obviously, you can't do that from humans. But now instead, we could take a skin biopsy from an affected patient or a blood sample from an affected patient, reprogram those into iPS cells, then make those iPS cells into cardiomyocytes that we could study in the dish to understand the disease process, or maybe to test various drugs to see if they'd be efficacious. And that's something that's happened already. I described how it's proven useful in the heart, but you could think about making any cell type for any kind of inherited or in some cases even acquired disease using those kind of models.
All right, awesome. I know you touched on using induced pluripotent stem cells to either model disease courses or even test drug therapies. What has that shown in the cardiac field to date?
Yeah, so it's still relatively early days. I guess people have been doing that kind of thing maybe for approaching just over a decade. Initially people were sort of doing almost what I would describe as more proof of concept kind of experiments. So taking a genetic disease, say a disease that causes electrical disturbances in the heart, and they tended to focus on maybe diseases where we understood the mechanisms quite well, the molecular sequence of events that leads to the patient's phenotype, the patient's, how they exhibit their disease, because they were trying to show that they could mimic that in the iPS system. And so it's kind of proving iPS, the validity of them as a model, rather than new investigations into how the disease is operating. I'd say it's only really maybe within the last 7 or 8 years or so that people have been taking less well understood diseases and trying to model those in the iPS systems. And there's a few examples that I'm aware of where people have use those, taking kind of a drug discovery approach and identify drugs. Sometimes these are drugs that are already available, say FDA or Health Canada approved, and then move those into patients. What's really only happened more recently is doing kind of large sort of population-based studies where you could kind of prospectively try to model this in larger populations. I think there's going to be more of that to come.
What would you say is the end goal of using induced pluripotent stem cells in the context of modeling disease and drug testing? Do you think it's to get new drugs approved or to somehow improve how we use our current medicines? Is there a certain formulation that we can come up with? Like, what do you think is the goal with that?
I think it's both. I think, you know, there's been an interest in trying to understand just the basic mechanisms of the disease. Again, a lot, you know, many of these are diseases where there previously wasn't access to tissue, or at least live tissue or live functioning cells. And so there's been a lot of work in that kind of direction. And maybe by understanding the disease process better, we might be able to better understand how to correct it or treat it. And one thing maybe we could talk about is that there's also been a lot of emphasis on the, if these are single gene abnormalities, going in and using another technology that's emerged in biology, which is gene editing through things like CRISPR, and going in and trying to correct the mutation and seeing how that changes the phenotype. That's almost an expectation now if you're doing these kind of modeling experiments. But there's also been a lot of interest, and a lot of this is being drawn by pharma. It's, you know, it's kind of large scale science, is again doing these kind of larger population based studies where, you know, maybe you have a range of disease cell lines and you're hitting them with large libraries of drugs to see what might be more efficacious. I think that's still in the early days. That's not the kind of work that we do in my laboratory. There's probably other people that can speak better, you know, the shining successes there. But a lot of that's going on.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Why don't we move back into using human pluripotent stem cells, whether it's induced or embryonic, in the context of animal models or doing what your lab is doing in terms of trying to create more regenerative type therapies?
To validate any novel therapy, to kind of sequentially go from small animal models, or usually talk about rodents like mice or rats, and gradually working your way closer to people. And so I'm embarrassed to say it was, what, 2005, 2007, we were doing sort of the initial studies in a rat model of myocardial infarction, a rat model of heart attack, if you will, and showed that you could take these human embryonic stem cell derived cardiomyocytes, and that they would stably engraft and replace a portion of the infarct scar. And they actually improve contractile function in those animal models. Now, one of the issues that has come up is that, and this is not unique to embryonic or pluripotent stem cells, but really any stem cell therapy or a lot of therapies in general, is, are they working directly or indirectly? So you can imagine, you know, the intuitive way and the way we were initially hypothesizing these cells were working is that we're transplanting cardiomyocytes, and those cardiomyocytes are hooking up with the rest of the heart electrically and firing in synchrony with it, providing new force-generating units. But there's another possibility, which is the cells could be operating indirectly. And usually what people talk about there is something called paracrine signaling, where you have these new engrafted cells and maybe they're releasing factors that are indirectly benefiting the heart, you know, by maybe releasing factors that cause the ingrowth of new blood vessels or prevent cell death that's occurring at low levels over time on the surviving heart muscle. And it turns out with the other type of stem cells, so-called adult stem cells, these are stem cells that are isolated from the body, no reprogramming step like we're talking about with iPS cells. People have pretty much shown that those cells don't give rise to new heart muscle. And if they're doing anything beneficial, they're operating through these indirect mechanisms. But the possibility was still out there with these real cardiomyocytes we were getting from pluripotent stem cells, they might be doing this directly. And we acquired the first data that this was possible some years ago. We actually created cells that flashed green light every time they fired. And so what we did was we transplanted those cells in an animal heart and then pointed a camera at the heart. And if we saw a flash of light, we knew that the cells were active electrically. And then we could ask whether that was firing in synchrony with the rest of the heart. And what we found is that is indeed the case, that these cells can one-to-one couple. And that's, of course, going to be necessary for them to to function as electrically integrated new force churning units. And I think that's unique to this cell type. It's not perfect. And so one of the issues that we've been focused on our laboratory is trying to improve the integration and coupling of these cells. All of that was done in small animal models. Some years ago, we switched to larger, more human-like models. The model that we're working in now, most heavily for this, is a pig model of myocardial infarction. And that's because the size, function, and structure of a pig heart is essentially identical to that of a human heart, or at least as close as you can get. And I don't know of a novel cardiovascular intervention that hasn't gone through the pig, at least any intervention that's been developed in the last 20 or 30 years, that hasn't gone through the pig at some stage of its preclinical development. And so we figured if we could do this, show that the cells were safe and effective in a pig, we'd feel a lot better about moving into humans. And so we've been focusing on a number of issues that have emerged since we started work in that model. The most important of which is probably the principal hurdle that we've had to translation. And something that you see in the large animal models, but we never saw historically in the small animal models. And that's that for the first, say, 3 to 4 weeks after we transplant these cells, we see an elevated risk of arrhythmias. So something that we didn't see in rodent models, probably because of the difference in heart rate across different species. So the heart rate in a mouse is over 600 beats per minute. Rats are 450. And humans, of course, are anywhere from 60 to 100. And that was, again, one of our reasons for focusing on work in the swine model. It's why you have to do large animal work. Turns out the heart rate of a pig is near identical to that of the human. And so when we transplanted these cells in a recipient that had a heart rate like you or I, we saw these transient arrhythmias. And so we've been focused really like a laser in the last several years in my laboratory on understanding the mechanistic basis of these arrhythmias and testing strategies to overcome that. And so we've taken what we think is a relatively systematic approach towards that. There's other hurdles out there that you might imagine that you can kind of address in some of these various preclinical models. We're going to have to work out ways to deliver the cells. Something that we're not working on, but other people in the field are very interested in, is how we're going to deal with the immune system. So in these various animal models, we're usually using pharmacologic immunosuppression with immunosuppressive drugs. But how might we prevent that if we're putting cells from one human being to another? There's all kinds of other interesting questions, like can we improve the efficacy of the cells, or can we show that they're efficacious in improving contractile function in the first place? And as from more of a basic science standpoint, we're also interested in understanding the fate of the cells. So how are they changing after we transplant them? Are they changing in terms of their gene expression and their functional properties over time? And that's not just because we're curious, although we are, but also because it may have implications on how this kind of therapy might behave in a human being over a longer period of time, and you know whether the beneficial effects, if any, would be durable.
For sure, that's definitely a lot to consider. Going back to the direct versus indirect effect of these transplants, what is the significance of knowing which mechanism the stem cells are working by?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it actually makes quite a bit of difference how the cells are operating. And as a historical example of how you can get in trouble if you don't understand that, in the early 2000s, there was a lot of excitement about this. It was actually based on a very small number of initial papers that were arguing that adult stem cells, again, stem cells that could be found from the body, could differentiate and give rise to unexpected cell types. And there was a paper saying you could take cells from the bone marrow, in particular hematopoietic stem cells, the cells that normally give rise to the circulating blood cells, your red and white blood cells, and that when you transplanted those cells in a heart, that they did something called transdifferentiation and gave rise to new muscle. Now, it turns out this was from a laboratory that later there actually was some controversy and some research integrity questions that came out of it. I think most people in the field think that doesn't happen. But there was confusion at the time because there was the suggestion that the cells were transdifferentiating and becoming heart muscle cells. But there was also data saying that these cells were maybe operating indirectly, you know, through this paracrine signaling we talked about before, maybe releasing factors that were promoting angiogenesis or blood vessel ingrowth in the surviving portions of the heart. There was a lot of confusion about it. But clinical trials were initiated. And so I think now we've had, and initially they were open label, so sort of initial clinical trials, and then they gradually transitioned to randomized clinical trials. And I think we've had somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 patients that have been enrolled in randomized clinical trials with these cells. And it's a bit controversial. It looks like they probably don't work, or if they mediate any beneficial effects, it's very small. But if we look back historically at those first studies, there's a tremendous amount of variability. So because people weren't clear how the cells were operating, they were getting varying doses, and I mean varying over three orders of magnitude in terms of the numbers of cells that were delivered to each heart. There was confusion about the right time to deliver the cells, right? Because if the cells are going to operate indirectly, it might be very dependent on the context, right? So it might be more useful in the acute phase to try to salvage the rest of the heart, but maybe after the damage has already occurred and scar tissue is already formed, probably going to be less useful. And so there was tremendous variation in terms of the timing of the intervention. And I think regardless of how folks in the field feel now about, you know, the potential for bone marrow cells, again, I think the preponderance of the field is that they probably don't work. I think everybody agrees that there was lost time and lost effort because we were confused about what we were delivering and how it might be operating. You know, in our case with pluripotent stem cell derived cardiomyocytes, the doses that we're using are very high. And that's because you lose on the order of a billion heart muscle cells during a typical human sized heart attack. If the cells were operating indirectly, presumably we don't need anywhere near a billion cells. We just need to have enough cells and in the right location and the right timing that they can release whatever the beneficial factors are. And so I think it's really important to understand these issues and kind of get our hands around it.
So is it more if we don't know if it's direct versus indirect, we won't know how many cells to transplant, and then two, whether or not they would have an impact in the acute versus chronic phase? Is that what we're getting at?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, and those are just two examples of parameters that you wouldn't understand if you don't know the mechanism, the, you know, the appropriate dose, you know, what sort of cell numbers, cell quantities are required, as well as the optimal timing of delivering. If you don't understand how your cell therapy is intervening in the disease process, when do you deliver it? Yeah.
Okay.
And I think it also impacts what cell type is going to be most appropriate at the end of the day. So people have described some of the mechanism by which some of these other cell types, for example, adult stem cells, mediate beneficial effects in the heart. And one of them is this formation of new blood vessels. When we've looked at that in our hands with the human pluripotent stem cell-derived cardiomyocytes, we don't see any evidence of new vessel growth, at least in the host. There's vessel growth in the graft that's being formed, but not in the host. And in other words, I think in terms of paracrine signaling and those kind of indirect mechanisms, these probably aren't going to be as effective as some other cell types that's whole job naturally is to release some of these factors, for example, proangiogenic factors. So I think it's, you know, there's certainly drugs that we prescribed for, you know, many, you know, years, you know, decades where we didn't understand how they were working. You know, people point to aspirin as kind of a classic example of this. And, you know, the most important thing we want to accomplish is to ameliorate human suffering and overcome the disease. But I think our likelihood of success is going to be higher if we have a good, solid understanding of what's going on.
This concludes the first part of our two-part series on the future of cardiac regeneration in medicine. Tune in next time for part two of the series, where Dr. LaFlamme will join us again to talk about the development of regenerative therapies to treat heart disease.